From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new study on the gender wage gap in Greater Boston finds that women earn 23% less than men.
Paying people equitably, that's what makes the businesses in Boston competitive, if they use 100% of their talent.
Also today, If Our Bodies Could Talk, a new book from Dr. James Hamblin explores questions about health, diet, and why we shouldn't sleep alone.
I just think people should be able to talk about it, that's all. You know, it's not for everybody. Some people sleep better when they're being held. It's not me.
Plus, Hiawatha Bray on the latest gadgets from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. From internet-enhanced hairbrushes to driverless cars.
We're talking highly automated vehicle in numerous situations by 2020. This will be in production, level 4 automation, so this is huge.
All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with some dramatic numbers on the gap between what men and women earn in Greater Boston. The study comes from the Boston Women's Workforce Council and City Hall, and it finds that on average, working women make 23% less than men, 77 cents on the dollar. Here are some more numbers from the study of 112,000 workers from 69 companies. The average salary for women, just under $79,000 a year. Men make more than $103,000. Men also make more than twice as much in bonuses as women do, according to this study. That there's a gender wage gap isn't news, but this is the first time researchers have used data collected directly from employers rather than from employees. So this study is considered very accurate compared to previous studies. At City Hall today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh characterized the new report as a call to action.
In 2017, it's time for us to stop talking and start to take action in closing the wage gap. And I think this report moves us more confidently in that direction.
So, as it is across the country, the gender wage gap is alive and well in Greater Boston. Joining us now for some context and insight is Megan Costello. She's the executive director in the mayor's office of women's advancement. She joins us now from City Hall. And Megan, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Anthony.
And here in the studio is Victoria Budson. She's founder and the executive director of the Women and Public Policy Program at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And Victoria, welcome to you. Good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. Nice to be here.
And Megan, let me start with you. Before the study, it was thought that Boston was doing a bit better than the national average. That estimate had women making about 83 cents for every dollar a man makes. This report is the wage shows a much larger wage gap. Is this a sobering report in your view?
Yeah, so Anthony, I think what's so exciting about today's report is really that this is the first time in our nation's history that we have actual wage data. The gender wage gap has been based on census data for a long time. It's been based on what employees give to the government. This is the first time that we're actually seeing employers give us data. And we have been able to anonymize and aggregate that data to understand the overall average, which is 77 cents. And so I don't think that this is necessarily new information. We know that the gender wage gap has existed for a long time. But we actually are now working with real evidence-based knowledge that's going to allow us to move forward.
Yeah. So this looked at 112,000 employees from 69 companies that participated voluntarily. How representative do you think these companies are of the total employment situation?
Sure. So our report actually does compare to the EEOC data of Greater Boston. And so it does give us a sample of understanding, you know, who these people are. Our sample, though, is a little bit higher when it comes to the number of women we have in our sample and also the number of women of color in leadership positions. And so we know it's not an exact science, but we do know that this is pretty representative based on real wage data.
Right. Now, Victoria Budson, I'd like to come to you. A 23% wage gap. What strikes you about this report?
You know, there's a number of pieces that are really important about what we've just learned. The first is this is 11% of the Greater Boston market of employees, which is a pretty large amount of data for us to have. And it also represents $11 billion in terms of company companies here. Now, this gives us for the first time a baseline that we can measure against. 179 different companies have signed the compact, and as Megan talked about, 69 provided data that was used in this report. If you imagine what can move forward from here, where perhaps the next year or the year after, when this report is repeated and we have more data, that we could end up perhaps with a sample that could be as large as 20%. Mm. So as important as what we learned today is, the most important thing is that this gives us a marker by which to compare against into the future.
Mm. And as we move forward, it would be more and more important for more and more companies to willingly participate in this compact. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And many of you will recall that the pay equity bill passed here in Massachusetts earlier this year. And what is so special about this project and the work that's come through Mayor Walsh and others is you have private sector businesses leading the way. Mm-hmm. So you have companies wanting to understand what are the wage gaps in their company. They want new tools to tackle them. They're creating a community where both evidence-based research from my center and others is shared, and they're sharing best practice. So instead of talking about what the gaps are, we're figuring out how to solve them.
So, Megan, let me ask, actually, I'd like to ask you both. I'll start with you, Megan. But just in terms of what can be done, Victoria made reference to a pay equity legislation on Beacon Hill. Mm-hmm. I know there at City Hall, you provide workshops, salary negotiation workshops for women. What else needs to happen to close this wage gap?
Sure. You know, this is a very complex problem, and you need many different solutions to solve it. It's not a one-size-fits-all. And so, we do a variety of things. The mayor has taken a multi-pronged approach to this work. We are the only city in the country to be doing so. We're big supporters of the legislation, and we know that is going to have a significant role here. We do provide free salary negotiation workshops for working women in the city of Boston. But we have to also talk to employers. And this is about going beyond legislation and beyond policy. This is about how are we actually experiencing the day-to-day in the workplace for women, and what are women doing, to negotiate their salaries and to talk about their salaries in the workplace.
Yeah. So talking to employers, Victoria, I want to ask you, I mean, obviously from a moral standpoint, it would seem to make sense to close the gender wage gap, but can we make an argument to businesses that it's good business to close the gender wage gap?
Absolutely. And what's terrific about the work of the Women's Workforce Council, and people can find this online in the reports, is it's very clear that if you can hire, retain, and promote the best talent, your companies are going to be more successful. And our economy here in Massachusetts, and particularly in Greater Boston, will be more successful. Right now, we're in a period of incredibly low unemployment, and companies have to work hard both to get talent and to retain that talent. Once you've invested in an employee, once you've hired someone on board, if you can't retain that person and promote them, then you're literally leaving money on the table, and further, you have to spend additional money to hire. Mm. What we find is the larger the business, or the larger, in the case of our work, the government, what you find is they want this information on how it is to make sure that they're paying people fairly and that people know it.
Mm. Yeah, go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, every company is different. Everybody has, their own unique problem or challenge. For some folks, it's about actually fixing dollars and cents and raising salaries. For others, it's about attracting women in the workforce. For others, it's about, promoting women in the workforce. And so you can't just have one solution. And that's why the work and the report that we put out today is so important, because it's business-led. It's business saying, this is the challenge that we have before us, and these are some of the things that we are doing to solve this problem.
Megan, does this study tell us anything about why this gap persists? I mean, I think the easy assumption to make is discrimination, that companies, for whatever reason, pay men more for reasons that aren't sound. But might it also have to do with the fact that, I don't know, in some companies there are more men who have more seniority, for example? I'm just asking that. I don't know.
Yeah, and I know Victoria can definitely speak to this as well, but you know, like I said, the wage gap is complex. It exists for a variety of reasons. We'd like to think that for most of the time it's not intentional, but there's certainly cases of being intentional about it. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with, again, the culture shift that needs to happen. This is not just about writing beautiful pieces of legislation that are certainly important and helpful, but this is about what is the actual culture change that we're having in our workplace. If you have flexible schedules in your HR handbooks, and if you have paid parental leave and all those great things in handbooks, that's awesome. But if nobody in your company is actually taking advantage because the culture doesn't call for that, that's the problem that we're trying to address.
Yeah, Victoria, same question to you.
Sure. So the wage gap is built over time. There's what takes place specifically in the company, but what we also know is when women both choose and are guided into college majors, which are not in science, technology, engineering, and math, and are focused on English literature or others, then you're segmenting even during the educational years in terms of whether women are going to have high or low wages. Then that continues on, and that women are usually underpaid within their first job. Until recently, we had a situation where most employers were going to peg that salary throughout the career to the prior salaries, and you would get a snowball effect. In addition, because we don't have transparency in wages in most organizations, women wouldn't know what other people are making. Mm. Women are more likely to be talking with friends who are also female about what they're making in the same field. So people may not be negotiating as significantly. And unfortunately, we also have implicit bias where people tend to underpay women's contribution. And we've got to solve all of those different pieces. You know, the research shows very definitively there's a real penalty for mothers. And so when women become mothers, they often have wages depressed after that. Men actually often get a bump because they're viewed as breadwinners. So we need to tackle all of these pieces. And what's so exciting about the work being done here in Boston is you have the whole community working on it. You have the Chamber of Commerce. You have the mayor's office. You have the legislature. You have major employers. You have women in the community literally coming out as individuals to go to these trainings. And we are going to be ahead of the game because we both have more inputs into how to solve it, and now we have a tool to measure the progress of that.
Megan, let me ask you, because the report also breaks down the gender wage gap by job category. Mm-hmm. What do those numbers tell us? Dive into those a little bit about the individual kinds of jobs and where and what kind of wage gap is displayed in those different kinds of jobs.
Sure. So this talks a lot about both the actual dollars and cents that women are getting paid compared to their male colleagues and also where women are in organizations. Our sample size, as I mentioned a little earlier, is a little bit greater when it comes to the number of women we have represented. But the job categories broken down will show you where, you know, the wage gaps are in different levels. So for example, at, you know, a mid-level, there might be a different number than at the executive level or at the admin level. And so understanding not only the general wage gap and the overall aggregate number is important, but also understanding where those gaps are at different levels of employment is really important.
Right. So were there, for example, different levels of employment that showed that women actually do better than men?
Absolutely. You know, in a couple of our samples, we saw that at the mid-level, women are making just over a dollar compared to their male colleagues in our sample, and also admin support workers as well. And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves, why does that happen? Hmm. And there could be a variety of reasons for that. We know that there are a lot of women at those different levels. But, you know, we also know that at the sales worker level and the laborers and helpers level, women are at 61 cents or 65 cents. So there's a significant gap that exists there.
Interesting. So as they move up, Victoria, it sounds like as they sort of move up in seniority, the wage gap would increase, it sounds like Megan's suggesting.
Well, that's right. A couple of things happen. One, we know that women aren't promoted with the same frequency as men, even when they have the same skill sets, years of experience, and track record. So we have a gap in promotion. Then further, when they are promoted, then we still have a gap in compensation. And we often talk about wages, but compensation goes beyond that. And this report, as you mentioned in the introduction, also focused on how you see real gaps in bonus pay, for example. But if you look across, there's many gaps that need to be solved, including that promotion gap and then the overall compensation.
Well, fascinating study and great insight from Victoria Budson. She's the founder and executive director of the Women and Public Policy Program at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Victoria, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Anthony.
And from Megan Costello, executive director for Women's Advancement at the City of Boston. Megan Costello, many thanks to you as well. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. We're going to check in with Boston Globe tech columnist Hiawatha Bray from Las Vegas at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas about all the new gadgets that are making a splash out there. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Here's how technology writer Hiawatha Bray began his column in the Boston Globe today. Maybe we should get President-elect Trump to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas and have him give a speech about making America weird again. That really made me want to read on. Every year, the show presents hundreds of the latest clever gadgets and devices. This year, they range from driverless cars to an internet-connected hairbrush. So joining us now from the 50th Annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, the capital of weird, is Hiawatha Bray, tech columnist for the business section of the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, welcome. Good to have you.
Oh, thanks to be. I'm glad to be here.
So
Go ahead.
You're about to jump in. Go right ahead.
No, I was just going
to
say that all I was doing was complaining about the fact that on my first day here, all the weird stuff seemed to have come from Europe and China. I just wanted to let you know that I finally found a really great weird product from the good old USA.
Oh, good. Well, tell us about that.
It's from a company you never would have expected. Whirlpool.
Whirlpool. Yeah, not exactly the avatars of weird, right.
Of Benton Harbor, Michigan, of all places. Good old Whirlpool. They are here with a device that is designed to make compost of all your kitchen waste in 24 hours.
Wow.
This is an $1,100 device that sits on the floor. You take your rotten tomatoes and your eggshells and all that. You dump it in there. You put in a chemical, and it grinds the stuff up. And in 24 hours at the bottom, you get mulch. And they're planning to try to sell this to the public. They're going to put it on Indiegogo to see if they can find people crazy enough to spend $1,100 on that. And it just but the reason I love stuff like that is because it sounds weird, but that's where the great new innovations are going to come from. The people who are going to try something that sounds absolutely nuts.
That's amazing.
And little by little, you come here to see this. I'm right now at the main convention center, but I should be over at the Sands Convention Center, because down in the basement, they have this thing called Eureka Park, where all the crazy stuff is, and I want to get in there and really find a lot of it.
All right. Well, I look forward to reading about more of that crazy stuff. But tell me, I wanted to ask you about cars, because it seems like there's a lot of talk about cars, particularly driverless cars, right?
You just don't know. This has turned into arguably America's most important auto show. I was talking to a guy from the German automotive press. He said increasingly German newspapers and magazines that cover the auto industry aren't even sending people to the Detroit Auto Show in January, which used to be the big one.
Of course.
They're sending them to CES. Nine of the world's major car companies are here. They are introducing all kinds of stuff here. Hyundai was here, and I got to ride around in their autonomous car. Really cool. I mean, you know, people are crossing in front of it. It just stops. The light turns red. It knows the light turns red. It even knows when it pulls up to an intersection that's legal to turn right on. It already knows that, and so it makes a right turn on red. It's amazing how far they've gotten. And the thing about the Hyundai car is most of these self-driving cars you see tested have all these gadgets on them, and the radars and the lasers, and you can tell there's something weird with them. This car looks like a car. You wouldn't know, except they had labels on it. You wouldn't know it was a self-driving car. That's how much better they're getting at it. But on the other hand, don't think you're going to see these things routinely on the roads for another 10 to 15 years. No way. It's going to take forever just to get the government approvals. But they're working, and they're amazingly good already.
Let me play a bit of tape from one of the big announcements out there. It came last night from Audi of America President Scott Keogh, who said the company's self-driving car, which uses artificial intelligence, will hit the market, as you suggested. Well, he says by 2020. Here's what he said.
We want to get to this nirvana state safer, and we want to get there sooner. And really, the only way to go about doing that, there's no amount of programming in the world that's going to manage the complexity of what happens in the street environments daily. The only way to get there is with artificial intelligence.
So the only way to get there is with artificial intelligence. What exactly is he referring to? I mean,
is that in the last few years, these guys have been able to do the most amazing advancements in getting computers to learn from real-world experience and change what they do. These cars are going to be out there with people behind the wheel to protect us, and they are going to just drive every road they can drive, and as they do, they record everything that happens, and they, in effect, think about it. just as a human does, and get better at it every time. Why do you think when you talk to your phone nowadays and use the speech recognition system, it's so accurate? It's because the computers learn now. And that's what he's talking about. The only way to get this right is to start putting more and more test vehicles on the road and have them learn their way around. And the more each of these vehicles learn, the more all of them learn. Because, like, for example, every Audi car that's out there on test, that information is shared with all the other Audi cars. And so there's this, going to be this exponential improvement in these things over time. And in a few years, they're just going to get so much more it's just going to be shocking how much better they're going to be in just a few years.
Do you think he's really going to get a self-driving car with all that artificial intelligence on to the market by 2020? That sounds incredibly optimistic to me.
That's the general area that all these companies, last year, Ford Motor Company walked in here and said 2021, we'll be selling them. They will sell them first as taxi cabs. They won't be selling to the general public. That's the thing. It's not that they're not going to have the technology. It's that it's going to take years for the average person to get hold of this. The early ones are probably going to cost well over $100,000. They're going to be sold to fleets. It's going to take years to get the pricing down. And it will be a long time before they become commonplace. Yeah. But yeah, I fully expect them to be selling them by 2020, 2021. All the major car companies plan to do it.
You know what I'm going to be really impressed is when these cars fly. Okay, I'm just saying that right now. I want them to fly.
I know. I'm that generation too. But no, I think this is much more interesting in many ways. But it is really a fascinating problem also philosophically. Because when that car stops, when it sees a person coming out into traffic, you begin to realize we've crossed a bridge here. Our relationship with machines is going to be permanently changed by the self-driving car, because now we are going to start thinking about cars as if they were really thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to really start thinking of machines as interacting with us the same way humans do. And that's going to change the way we think about computers, robots, cars permanently. Once these things hit the road, it's like a turning point.
Wow. Well, speaking of thinking about things differently, let's get back to some of the weird stuff. So am I right? An internet-powered hairbrush?
Not quite. It's a hairbrush that talks to your smartphone. This is about one of the most important things that's happened in the last 10 years, too, which I would call the sensor revolution. The fact that you can put little chips into devices that can measure practically anything you can think of. Mm. They put a microphone in this. They got an accelerometer in it. They got a gyroscope in it. Nowadays, all those things just cost pennies. You put them into a device, and you can actually listen to the brush going through your hair. You can detect the number of strokes and the angle at which you're holding the brush. And the handle of the brush will vibrate to tell you you're doing it wrong. And it will transmit over a Bluetooth radio to an app on your phone a sort of a pattern showing here's how dry your hair is based on the noise it makes when you pull your brush through it. Here's how many strokes you did. Here's the parts of your hair you remembered to brush and the parts you didn't remember to brush.
Now, did you try this brush, Hiawatha?
No, I asked. And the lady said, no, your hair, it is too short. It was like, forget this. And she's right.
Oh, that's fun.
I don't think they need to have a bald spot. They actually do. I didn't try that. There's a helmet in here you're supposed to wear. It shines light on your head and it grows hair. And I don't know if it works or not, but this is the second year they're here, so they aren't out of business yet. So.
All right. Well, that's Hiawatha Bray. He's technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe, reporting from the 50th annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Hiawatha, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
All
right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Let's turn now to the Remembrance Project. Writer Alyssa Elies look at the extraordinary lives of people from our community. Today, Alyssa recalls the relatively brief life of a young man from the town of Harvard, Massachusetts.
Even before he was born, Michael Hazel made someone else's life easier. Gina Hazel's pregnancy was a joy, and her delivery was over in an hour and a half. Michael came into the world giving. By his own account, he was just an ordinary guy. By his mother's, he was a man of few words who managed to matter in 100 ways. When Michael was a boy, someone in their small town had the tremors and disfigurement of Parkinson's disease. Kids were casually mocking him one day.
He was always very quiet, but he immediately stood up, I guess, and said, "Hey, you know, you don't make fun of him. He's my mother's friend." And I thought, oh my gosh, you know. It just kind of warms your heart, warms your soul that he, you know, was like that.
Michael loved being outdoors, hiking, hunting, snowmobiling. By 3, he was pushing a chair around a hockey rink on skates. but mostly he loved to ski, and he shared his passion with the twin siblings who adored him. After college, he lived at home, allegedly saving money, when he bought his younger brother an expensive set of skis for his birthday, just for the joy of skiing together. He also shared his passion with the friends he held close.
Even when he went skiing in January, he went out and he bought 8 ski tickets at a very expensive mountain, and I said, 8 ski tickets? And he says, oh yeah, you know, I want to go skiing with my friends. Like, he just didn't think much of it, you know, he was just a giver.
Towards the end of that trip, doing what he loved, Michael's Subaru missed a sharp turn on a Vermont back road. It was early, an icy morning. The car veered and struck a tree. Hundreds and hundreds of people waited in line at the wake. The family had come early, and Gina wasn't sure how they would survive.
All of a sudden, as the four of us were in this room, it blizzardly snowed out of nowhere. It was just snowing, 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 and all four of us were just like, oh my gosh. You know, that's a sign for Mike, because he loved the snow. He loved skiing. He loved winter. He loved the outdoors. And we thought that that was just him saying that he's okay and that he'll always be with us.
Michael's father is a volunteer firefighter, and the department showed in uniform for the funeral. After the reception, there was a noise outside. The fire station and engine bells were ringing. They rang and rang and rang. In farewell to this generous man who had always made so little noise himself.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Michael Hazel, who died last January in a car crash in Vermont. If you'd like to suggest someone for a remembrance, send us an email to remember@wbur.org. Stay with us. Coming up, If Our Bodies Could Talk, doctor and journalist James Hamblin is in the studio to take your calls. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. So what's the best exercise? What should you eat? How much sleep do you really need? Questions like these have spawned thousands of blogs, advice columns, books, and videos about how to have a healthier, calmer, less stressful life. Now, my next guest, James Hamblin, knows a lot about these complicated questions. He's a medical doctor turned journalist who hosts a web series for The Atlantic called If Our Bodies Could Talk. Now he's published a book by the same name in which he answers dozens of questions, from how much sleep we need to whether wine is good for you to why men have nipples. James Hamblin will be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight, and he joins us now in the studio as well as on Facebook Live. And James Hamblin, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's I've really been having fun jumping around this book. Now, we want to invite our listeners into this conversation. What's your burning question about your health? How your body works, diet, sleep, food supplements, coffee, and alcohol. How do you find your way through the maze of blogs and books about health? What's your question for Dr. James Hamblin? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter and at Radio Boston. Let me start with just this particular question that I made reference to, and that is this maze of writing and blogs and books about issues having to do with health. So many fads out there. What did you want to add to that sort of maze of literature with this book?
Yeah, I thought there was just too much out there, so why don't I solve the problem by adding to it?
Right, of course.
I think there are a lot of question and answer books about body trivia and you know, a lot of lifestyle health books out there, and it seems like a lot of them have their different philosophy, their different solution, often a silver bullet for how you should eat, how you should exercise, how to sleep. And so I tried to just kind of sift through a lot of the different ideas out there and try to figure out where we actually know things and can be informed, and where there's a lot of ambiguity and we need to embrace it.
Yeah. Now, you write, one of the things that I found in this book, you write, many of the answers in this book are stories about why we don't have concrete answers. You say that sometimes the most interesting thing is knowing why we don't know, and the point is in the considering and being comfortable in not knowing. health is a balance between acceptance and control. I like that paragraph a lot, but I'd love you to expand on it a little bit, especially this idea being comfortable both in knowing and not knowing.
Yeah. I guess a good example of that is, I mean, a lot of people, when you're diagnosed with any sort of medical condition, be it diabetes, cancer, all kinds of different things that we have good frameworks for scientifically as to how they're working at a biological, at a cellular level, and what makes people more likely to get them. But it's hard to ever trace these things back to exactly what was the cause, what was the moment. Mm. Almost never is it a single particular gene or a single incident of which cigarette caused this to happen. It's this complex milieu of conditions and the way we live and the genes we inherited and every daily decision that we make. And a lot of people, when they're in dire situations, want to look back and point a finger at one thing.
At one thing, right. It seems like, too, we also want to believe, and I think you made mention of this earlier, to sort of one silver bullet. I mean, for example, when it comes to diet, there are diet fads, whether it's the paleo diet or fat is good, fat is bad. I mean, and I guess one of the answers that sort of comes out of that is it's not one size that fits all, right?
Right, right. Which diet is a great example of some place where it seems like you're hearing a lot of competing, conflicting messages, and we in the media tend to be guilty of that too, because you know what makes a good story is something that's upending conventional wisdom, something that's changing the way you thought about everything, and you know, and that's just not the way science works. It's at odds with this idea that we do learn new things, but it grows slowly and incrementally, and ultimately you make decisions based on a body of evidence that grew over years, decades. Right. Which is harder to make a headline out of.
That's right. We're talking to Dr. James Hamblin. He's a senior editor of The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight. And you can join this conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook Live if you want to follow this conversation on Facebook. Let's go to Katie, who's calling from Wellesley with a question about alcohol. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Hello, doctor. My question is, am I helping or hurting myself by having, say, 3 glasses of red wine a week?
Oh, I can answer that. You're helping yourself, obviously. No, go ahead, doctor.
we think that sounds to me like it's within the range, which for most people would be healthy. But the most data that we know about that comes from studies where you look at huge populations and you say, the longest-lived, healthiest people in the world, what are they eating? And often we see low to moderate consumption of alcohol being part of that. Mm-hmm. But the experts also mostly say that if you aren't drinking, if you don't drink at all, there's no reason to start, to introduce it. So low to moderate seems to be fine. Also, nothing at all seems to be fine.
All right, Katie, thanks for that. I want to ask you a little bit about sleep, because you've written a lot about sleep. And you start by talking about your experience with sleep deprivation when you were a medical resident and you worked shifts that lasted 36 hours. And you sort of make the point that, what was that like? And what did you learn about what the lack of sleep does to a human body?
Yeah. Well, lots of stories about that. Technically, they were 30-hour shifts. That's the mandatory limit.
Yeah.
But just the nature of the work in the hospital, people keep getting sick. There's always someone else who needs you, and you don't want to abandon your team, so people ended up staying longer a lot of the time. I think once you've put yourself to that extreme of sleep deprivation, for me, it took that extreme to realize the importance of sleep in my cognitive functioning, and to realize, yeah, that you can simply space things. There's a time I read about in the book where I just found myself in a very serious situation, talking about transferring a patient to the ICU, talking with their family about an advanced directive, and I remember laughing, and it was just mortifying. I had to hide it, but I was not funny. I was not thinking.
So it was just sort of sleep deprivation, giddiness.
It was
almost
a little bit of delirium, yeah. Really. It was scary. And the underlying point of what the researchers that I spoke to about sleep kept telling me is you don't really appreciate your own how incapacitated you are when you're sleep deprived.
Right. Which leads to the question, how much sleep do we actually need? I mean, is there a golden number that we should all sort of have in our minds?
Right. That's the challenge of public health, is trying to make recommendations for groups of people and at the same time recognizing that everyone is unique. But mm-hmm. when the best reviews of all the research out there tend to put the answer at 7 hours for people. And yet we know that there's a very small number of people who do just fine on much, much less.
Much less. You know, I talked to a sleep expert a few years back when I was having some sleep problems, and he said it's a mistake to think about everyone needing the same amount of sleep, just as it is to, you know, in the same way that some people are tall, some people are short, some people need 10 hours of sleep, and there's nothing wrong with that if they need it, and some people can do just fine on 4.5 hours of sleep, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. It seems so. There's also value in the behavioral psychology of having a number, a goal,
yeah,
in mind. So everyone is probably slightly different, but we do tend to cluster in our need around that 7 hour mark.
Let's take some more calls for Dr. James Hamblin. His book is called "If Our Bodies Could Talk: A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body." Let's go to Una, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Una.
Hi, Anthony and Dr. Hamblin. My question is about muscle building. So I'm a vegetarian, so I can't really get protein from whole foods that easily. So I've been seeing a lot of people online say, like, you should take protein powder, but I was just wondering, is it bad for you because it's unnatural, or, like, should you keep the dosage under a certain amount, and is there differences from men and women for how much you can have?
Protein powder.
That there are a lot of questions to be answered there. I think the first one is the basic premise, and I think a lot of nutritionists would tell you that you can get plenty of protein on a vegetarian or vegan diet. You have to work a little harder at it given the food system that we live in and it, meat and cheese being all around us, but you can do it, and it's rarely necessary to supplement with protein, and that actually, a lot of people are just excreting the protein that they're buying in powders. But as for specific safety concerns, I'm not aware of them. It's more just a concern of potentially wasting money.
Yeah, I mean, you write. First of all, I want to just put the number out again. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to make the connection with Dr. James Hamblin. You also write about these food supplements as being a little bit of a hoax in many cases. So tell me about your concerns about this industry, and maybe beginning with exactly what we mean by food supplements.
Right. It started out a long time ago when people realized that sailors were getting scurvy if they didn't have vitamin C, discovered what vitamin C was, and thought, well, you know, what if we could isolate something like that, and that would be a supplement. You don't have to actually suck on a lime like sailors were doing, but just the vitamin C. So it was sort of a logical extension of this is something that would have come in your food, and you can take it without. And now it has become a big umbrella term for all kinds of different compounds, and not just a multivitamin, but all kinds of different herbs and extracts and combinations of different vitamins in huge doses.
Not regulated, right?
Yeah. The industry does not like saying that they're not regulated. There are ways to, if you find that a product has been tainted, has been harming people, it will be recalled and removed from the shelf. So we have that retroactive safety, but it's very different from the pharmaceutical industry where things have to be tested and prove at least somewhat effective before going to market.
Yeah, yeah. But in general, your view is there a bit of a scam being waged out there?
There is a much lower bar for what can be said about these products, the claims they can make on labels. Mm-hmm. It's stuff we want to believe. If you take something that says it's going to promote heart health, or, you know, it's an easy sell, and a lot of them are not substantiated and could be a waste of money. Sometimes could be potentially harming us. We don't know.
Let's go to Tina, who's calling from Acton. Hi, Tina. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the body and aging. I had a horseback riding accident when I was in high school, and now I'm in my 60s, And what kind of reasonable expectation should I feel about, you know, the aging process and injury? Because I've had pain there on and off in my hip all my life. Is it going to increase? Should I do more yoga exercises?
I'm sorry to hear that. This is one where, you know, you'd have to take it on a case-by-case basis, and I'd refer you to hopefully you have a good relationship with a family physician and physical therapist who can help with that. And the general recommendation is to exercise and stretch as long as your body can handle it. But if there's a specific injury, you don't want to exacerbate that. So that has to be the case-by-case basis.
Tina, thanks for the call, and good luck with those old injuries. We wish you well. Let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Concord. Jerry, you're on the air.
Thank you. I've been trying to just stay healthy by doing slow jog for many years, and I've settled on about 40 miles a week is what I thought works for me. I never try and race, never try and go fast. But the last few years, I'm getting disproportionately slower every year, and I don't understand why. I mean, I've gone from 9-minute miles up to like 14-minute miles, and my weight's the same, and my diet's the same, and I hang in there. It just seems like too big a change, and yet whenever I talk to the doctor, he says, well, you know, you're getting older.
You don't want to accept that, Jerry?
Well, I'm jogging to 40 miles a week to fight that. Is it just age? Is there nothing I can do here?
What do you think, James?
Yeah, I'd have to defer to your doctor on that too. I know that there is an inevitable decline in our performance, and that sounds like a relatively rapid one. But I'd have to trust your doctor and saying there's not something else.
But James, just following up on Jerry's conversation, I mean, what happens to the body as we age? I mean, in sort of understanding how this body performs, if our bodies could talk, what's Jerry's body saying to him as it ages?
Yeah, that's an interesting. if you're to take the title of the book literally, and often your body might be telling you to slow down and to not to run 40 miles a week, yet we know that there's a certain point where you need to push yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Exercise is one of those. You can certainly overdo it, but we know that long term, if you can live a generally active lifestyle, you'll have more healthy years.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Dr. James Hamblin. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight discussing his book and signing copies. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call right now. I want to ask you a little bit about your career. You're a radiologist by training. What led you away from practicing medicine to writing about
Well, I did 2 years of radiology residency, so I never actually practiced as an attending physician. At the time, I got the opportunity to work with The Atlantic, and I just really enjoyed writing, and this has been a nice marriage of my creative instincts and curiosity about the world and all these questions that are still unanswered, and so I took this job with The Atlantic and have been writing now for 5 years and haven't gone back, but the future is wide open.
It's wide open. So you might go back and be a practicing physician one of these days?
Oh, I never want to stop writing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that could be the
part. All right. More questions from listeners. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Needham. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with artificial sweeteners. They seem to have come in waves. There was like NutraSweet from like way back in the day, and then more recently there was Sucralose and the Splenda brand. And then we've got extracts from plants like stevia and monk fruit now. I'm wondering if all of those are the same, if they're all bad, if some of them are good, or if all of them are better than sugar, or if there's some sort of, you know, thing about all of them that we haven't quite got figured out. Do they interact with the mouth differently than the stomach and the pancreas and all of that?
All right, great question about artificial sweeteners there,
yeah,
Doctor.
Yeah, I think I could write a book on that right now. and just like anything, just like when you're talking about supplements, just like when you're talking about pharmaceuticals, yeah, each one of these is going to have its own properties, its own potential concerns, its own potential benefits. When if you have to break it down to a simple rule of thumb, most nutritionists will say, treat it like a crutch if you're trying to get yourself off of, you know, drinking a lot of soda. Transition to the diet, but don't be having it with every meal every day. And that's not because of clear, definite cause for concern about health risks, but just generally moderation is the way to go when we're in doubt about these things as we learn more.
Moderation in general is the approach. I want to ask you, I'm looking at some of your chapter headings, so I want to ask you about eggs versus oatmeal. And this is interesting to me because it gets to this point about how these fads change. I mean, I have distinct memory as a kid. And so I grew up in the sort of 60s, 70s era. And I remember my parents, my father in particular, being a real believer in protein, protein, protein. And he would make us eat eggs in the morning. You have to have eggs, eggs, eggs. And then, you know, we went through this phase where, no, eggs are bad. Eggs are full of cholesterol and, you know, you got to have oatmeal. And now suddenly eggs are back. And I'm sort of delighted that eggs are back. But where should we be in this eggs versus oatmeal quandary?
Yeah, yeah. Part of that is that the science on nutrition has progressed, as science does, in a way that initially some people, when nutrition science was very young decades ago, it's some people believed that saturated fat was a major, maybe the major driver of heart disease. And then as new studies emerged, recommendations have changed. We're not as concerned about it. Some people are not concerned about it at all. So it can be confusing, and it's partly exacerbated by media stories, which tend to be thinking about saturated fat is all good, or just eat as much of it as you want. Mm-hmm. And people who want to interpret it that way. But the message all along, really, I think, if you look for a consistent theme, there's been moderation, balance. Things that are easier said than done. But
so maybe an egg on Monday and Wednesday and Friday and some oatmeal on Tuesday and Thursday.
And we also have to look at the sustainability of how these foods are produced and how
right.
we feed the growing population.
All right, let's go to Jasmine, who's calling from Winchester. Hi, Jasmine, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is around resting heart rate. I have a Fitbit that measures my resting heart rate every morning. And the claim is that that's a reflection of the health of your heart. Is that true?
Yeah, it tends to be that when there's variation within the population of what people's resting heart rates are, but when a certain person starts working out more, you can lower your resting heart rate. So generally, that is a true thing.
So resting heart, so a low resting heart rate, a good thing.
Often.
Yeah.
Often
yeah.
a good thing, not necessarily.
I think we've got time for one or maybe two more questions. Let's go to Diane, who's calling from Scituate. Hi, Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I would like to ask the doctor about his opinion of probiotics. You talked about protein powders and the marketing and how we're, you know, getting ripped off. I was wondering about probiotics. Seems to be such a trend. You go into CVS and there's hundreds to choose from now. So what is your opinion on taking or not taking probiotics?
Dr. Hamblin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a trend that you're going to see more and more and more of over the years. We've only recently come to appreciate that there are more microbes in our bodies than there are human cells, and we want to optimize those populations and that they're intimately tied to health. So then immediately there's a flood of products that are saying that they can do that. But right now we know that everyone's populations are very different, and we don't exactly know how to manipulate those populations in any specific way. So an analogy is sort of like reaching into a bag that says seeds and then going over to a park and throwing them into the park and thinking, is this going to be good for the ecosystem there? and you don't know what the seeds are, if they're going to take, if it's going to create an invasive species, if it's going to do nothing, most likely do nothing. Yeah.
So, James Hamblin, we only have 30 or 40 seconds left or so. So let me just sort of close by sort of asking you finally, in writing this book, If Our Bodies Could Talk, you know, how do you hope people will start thinking differently about their bodies, about their health? What's the sort of core underlying message here?
I hope that it equips people to deal with this new information-heavy age where we're... The patient-physician relationship has shifted in a way that everyone is diagnosing themselves and coming into their doctors with a stack of papers they printed out, and they're pretty sure what they have. And then these new news stories every day, and it's just a lot to deal with. And so I think thinking about the history of medicine and science can help inform and make us comfortable dealing with this new information as it hits us day after day.
All right. Well, the book is If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Dr. James Hamblin, he's senior editor of The Atlantic, and he'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight discussing his book. And James Hamblin, real pleasure. Thanks for coming in. We're very grateful.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.